carders and the militia enforced discipline, sometimes punishing underachievers with beatings. At the end of the day, villagers returned to their living quarters, assigned according to each person's work shift. Meetings followed in the evening to evaluate each worker's performance and review the local tactics. Labour was appropriated by the communes, men and women being at the command of team leaders, more often than not without adequate compensation. Explained party secretary Zhang Xianli in Macheng, "Now that we have communes, with the exception of a chamber pot, everything is collective, even human beings." This was understood by poor farmer Lin Zhengqi to mean, "You do whatever you are told to do by a carder." Wages, as a consequence, were virtually abolished. Members of a production team, working under the supervision of a squad leader, were credited with points instead, calculated according to a complex system based on the average performance of the team as a whole, the job carried out, and the age and gender of each worker. At the end of the year, the net income of each team was distributed among members according to need, and the surplus was in principle divided according to the work points that each had accumulated. In practice, a surplus hardly ever existed, as the state came in and took the lot. Work points, moreover, devalued rapidly during the Great Leap Forward. In Jiangying County, just outside Nanjing, one workday was equivalent to 1.05 yuan in 1957. A year later, it was worth no more than 28 cents. By 1959, its value had declined to a mere 16 cents. Locals refer to the point system as beating a drum with a cucumber. The harder you beat, the less you heard, as all incentives to work had been removed. Some never got paid at all. Chun Yuquan, a sturdy young man interviewed in February 1961 in Xiangtan County, Hunan, recalled that he had made a total of 4.50 yuan in 1958, with which he bought a pair of trousers. The following year, having been dispatched to a coal mine where no record of work was kept, he did not receive anything. Some communes did away with money altogether. In Longchuan County, Guangdong, villagers who sold their pigs were handed credit notes instead of cash, prompting people to slaughter and eat the animals themselves. But in many cases, villagers had to borrow from the commune, entering a form of bonded labour. Li Yeye, who had to feed his chronically ill wife and five children by carrying manure all day long, never had any cash. People like us had no money. We were constantly in debt. We had to pay back our debt to the commune. Feng Dabai, a barber from northern Sichuan, who looked after a family of nine during the famine, had to borrow so much food that he was still paying off his debt 50 years later. In the most radical communes, private plots, heavy tools and livestock all had to be turned over to the collective. In many cases, people were allowed to keep nothing but the bare essentials. As Li Qingquan, the leader of Sichuan, put it, "Even shit has to be collectivized." In response, villagers tried to salvage as much of their property as possible. They slaughtered livestock, hid grain and sold assets. At the very start of the movement, Hu Yongming, a farmer from the humid, hilly northeast of Guangdong, killed four chickens, followed on day two by three ducks. Then came three female dogs, the puppies being slaughtered next. Finally, the cat was eaten. Many did the same, as farmers devoured poultry and livestock. Throughout the villages of Guangdong, chicken and ducks were eaten first, followed by hogs and cows. Local officials, keen on numbers, thought that the consumption of pork and vegetables alone increased by some 60% with the advent of the communes, as locals consumed the produce of their private plots in fear of collectivization. A common saying in Guangdong was, "What you eat is yours, what you don't is anyone's. A similar scenario followed in the cities, although attempts to impose urban communes were generally abandoned until a few years later. In the first few weeks of October 1958, over 500,000 yuan was withdrawn from the bank in one single district in Guangzhou. In Wuhan, there was a run on the bank, a fifth of all savings having been cashed within 2 days of the foundation of the East Commune. Some workers in small enterprises even sold the sewing machines on which they relied for their livelihoods, others tearing up the floorboards of their homes for timber to be sold as fuel. Afraid that their savings would be confiscated, once parsimonious people started to indulge in conspicuous consumption. Ordinary workers bought expensive brands of cigarettes and other luxury goods. Some even splurged on extravagant banquets. Rumours fired collective fears. It was said that in some villages each person was allowed only a blanket, everything else being communal. Even clothes have numbers. In the drive to increase production and meet even higher targets, homes were also confiscated. The commune, after all, needed bricks for the canteens, dormitories, nurseries, and retirement homes planned on paper. In Macheng, as we have seen, houses were initially pulled down for fertilizer, a trend made worse by the advent of the people's communes. Throughout the county, villagers started sharing houses, some families ending up in makeshift sheds. Recalcitrant farmers were told that no grain rations will be issued to those who do not move out. In some villages, a grandiose vision of modernity justified the elimination of old houses. In Guishan Commune, 30 dwellings were pulled down to make way for a utopian plan in which paved streets and skyscrapers would replace the mud huts lining dusty lanes. Not a single new house was built, and some families ended up living in pigsties or abandoned temples, with rain leaking through the roof and wind blowing through porous walls built of mud and straw. "Destroying my home is even worse than digging up my ancestor's gravestone," one villager cried. But few dared to complain. Most quietly stood by, sometimes in tears, as the local leader walked past without uttering a word, simply lifting his finger to mark out a house for destruction. In Tianjin County, Sichuan, a team of 11 people went around torching hundreds of straw huts. "Destroy straw huts in an evening. Erect residential areas in 3 days. Build communism in 100 days. Was the leading slogan. Some villages were emptied altogether, although somehow nobody quite managed to get beyond the destruction phase of the plan. Houses were also pulled down specifically to separate men from women in the great drive to regiment the countryside. In Jingying, Gansu, some 10,000 dwellings were pulverized during the Great Leap Forward on the order of provincial boss Zhang Zhongliang. Most of the displaced people ended up not in dormitories, as envisaged by model communes, but living on the streets, destitute. Except for the most deprived villages, most people did not like the canteens, if only because sprawling collectives run on a shoestring could hardly cater to individual whims, tastes, and diets. Some people had to walk for many kilometers to reach the collective facilities. In Hunan, over two-thirds of all villagers were opposed to communal eating, according to the head of the province, Zhu Xiaoqiu. Across the county, carders had to apply pressure to get the villagers into the canteens. In Macheng, they used a simple but effective approach, by simply cutting off grain supplies to the village. But families who had hoarded their own provisions still failed to turn up. They were denounced as rich peasants, intent on sabotaging the people's communes. The militia then stepped in, patrolling the streets and fining families who had smoke escaping from the chimney. The final step was house-to-house confiscation of food and utensils. Once they sat down, villagers tucked in with a vengeance, all the keener as the new facilities had been set up with funds, food and furniture taken from the village. In one commune in Macheng, some 10,000 pieces of furniture, 3,000 hogs and 57,000 kilos of grain, as well as countless trees, chopped down from private plots for fuel, went into the canteens. Their labour exploited, their possessions confiscated, and their homes demolished, villagers were presented with an opportunity to share in their leader's vision. Communism was around the corner, and the state would provide. To each according to his needs was taken literally, and for as long as they could get away with it, people ate as much as they could. For about 2 months, in many villages throughout the country, people stretched their bellies, following Mao's directive at Suzhou. You should eat more. Even 5 meals a day is fine. Especially in regions where crops other than food were grown, for instance cotton, restraint was less pronounced, as the grain was provided by the state. Workers stuffed themselves, some being scolded for lack of appetite. Leftover rice was poured down the toilet by the bucket load. In some teams, people held competitions to see who could eat the most, children being reduced to tears for failing to keep up. Others took Mao at his word, launching a Sputnik by having 5 meals a day. Food that would have fed a village for half a week vanished in a day. In Jiangning County, Jiangsu, some villagers gobbled down a kilo of rice in a sitting. Extravagance in consumption was even greater in the cities. Some 50 kilos of rice ending up in the gutter on a single day in late 1958 in a Nanjing workshop. Steamed dough buns blocked the toilets. One punctilious inspector noted that the rice on the bottom of a sewage vat was 30 centimetres thick. In some factories, workers wolfed down up to 20 bowls of rice a day. The leftovers were fed to the pigs. The feast did not last. Chapter 8. Steel Fever. Stalin had financed industry at the expense of agriculture, as punishing procurements drained the countryside of all wealth. In search of an alternative to the Soviet model, Mao instead wanted to bring industry to the village. Industrial output in the people's communes could be raised immediately by relying on inexpensive innovations and indigenous techniques which did not require large amounts of investment, leading to an instant jump in productivity. This, in turn, would galvanize the villages to achieve even greater economic targets. Here was the key to industrializing a backward countryside without big foreign investment. Bourgeois specialists were excoriated as conservative rightists, while the earthbound wisdom of simple peasants was hailed instead. In Yunnan, party boss Si Fuzi openly scoffed at geological measurements and technological surveys recommended by Russian experts, relying instead on the wisdom of the masses in building dams and reservoirs. Intuitive knowledge and native ingenuity, rather than foreign expertise, would introduce cheap and effective innovations that would propel the villages of China past the Soviet Union. The countryside was to be mechanized through simple devices, developed by ordinary farmers in research institutes. "The humble are the cleverest, the privileged are the dumbest," Mao wrote in a report showing how workers had managed to build a tractor by themselves. Or, as Si Fuzi claimed, repeating words of wisdom from the chairman, "We are supernatural. Maybe we are supernaturals of the second order. Maybe on another planet there are people who are brighter than we are, in which case we are of the second order. But if we are brighter than they are, then we are supernaturals of the first order." Model workers peopled party propaganda. He Ding, a poor farmer from Hunan, who never had a day of schooling in his life, devised a system of wooden earth carriers moving on overhead cables with an automatic dump and return mechanism, which reduced the amount of labour needed to build a reservoir by 8 times. Wooden conveyor belts, wooden threshing machines and wooden rice planting machines all were hailed as everyman miracles. In Shanxi province, villagers even trotted out native cars and locomotives. Every part was made of wood. Most of these were innocent enough, but the waste could reach huge proportions. In Diaofang commune, Guangdong, some 22,000 beams, trusses and floorboards were torn out of people's homes overnight in a movement to mechanize the commune. The carts produced were so ramshackle that they fell to pieces the moment anyone tried to use one. But the real benchmark was steel. Here was material worthy to stand for socialism. Hard, shiny, industrial, modern and working class. Stalin stood for a man of steel, willing to smash all the enemies of revolution to smithereens. Smoking factory stacks, whirring machine tools, the hooting of factory whistles, towering blast furnaces glowing a deep red with fire. These were the consecrated images of a socialist modernity. Alexei Gostev, the worker poet, wrote, "We grow out of iron. As man coalesced with iron, in a fusion announcing a world in which machine became man, and man was a machine." Steel was the sacred ingredient in the alchemy of socialism. The amount of steel produced was a magic figure recited with religious fervor in socialist countries. Steel output magically distilled all the complex dimensions of human activity into a single precise figure that indicated where a country stood on the scale of evolution. Mao may not have been an expert on industry, but he seemed able to rattle off the steel output of virtually every country at the drop of a hat. He was possessed by steel, and overtaking Britain increasingly meant outstripping its annual steel production. Steel was the prime mover in the escalation of targets, and he pushed hard to have its output increased. It was 5.35 million tons in 1957. The target for 1958 was set at 6.2 million in February 1958, which was increased to 8.5 million tons in May, until Mao decided in June that 10.7 million tons could be produced. This changed to 12 million tons in September. As he juggled with the numbers, he became convinced that by the end of 1960, China would catch up with the Soviet Union, the United States being overtaken in 1962, when an output of 100 million tons would be achieved. Then China would pull away, reaching 150 million tons in a few years. 700 million tons of steel would be produced by 1975, leaving Britain trailing far behind. Mao was encouraged in his ravings by some of his close colleagues. Li Fuchun, for one, pronounced that China could develop at a speed unprecedented in human history, thanks to the superiority of the socialist system. Britain could be outstripped in a mere 7 years. Then he presented an extravagant plan seeking to overtake Britain in iron, steel, and other industrial commodities in less than 3 years. In early June 1958, as Mao lounged by the swimming pool and asked Minister of Metallurgy, Wang Heshu, if steel production could be doubled, the minister replied, "No problem." Ke Qingxi bragged that East China alone could produce 8 million tons. Provincial leaders such as Wang Rensong, Tao Zhu, Xi Fuzhu, Wu Zipu, and Li Qingquan all made extravagant pledges about steel production, indulging the chairman in his visionary whims. The key to success was small furnaces operated by villagers in every backyard of the people's communes. Built of sand, stone, fire clay or bricks, they were relatively simple affairs, allowing every villager to be mobilized in the effort to overtake Britain. A typical backyard furnace was some 3 or 4 meters high, with a wooden platform at the top, supported by beams. A sloping ramp provided access to the furnace, farmers scuttling up and down with sacks of coke, ore and flux on their backs or baskets slung on long poles. Air was blown through the bottom, the molten iron and slag being released through tap holes. Based on traditional blast methods, some may well have worked, but many were a sham, forced on the communes by carders in the grip of steel fever. The drive reached a climax in the late summer of 1958. Chen Yun, the party planner who had fallen into disgrace earlier in the year, was put in charge of the movement, and worked hard to redeem himself. On the 21st of August, he transmitted orders from Mao that not a ton below target would be tolerated. Failure to fulfill the plan resulting in punishments ranging from a warning to expulsion from the party. To maintain momentum, Mao visited Wuhan in September to inaugurate a giant iron and steel combine built with Soviet help, watching the molten iron from the first firing come out of the furnace. That same day, Beijing dispatched a team of 1,500 party activists to spread out over the country, whipping up support for the steel drive. Then, the 29th of September, was designated as the day to achieve an even higher target in celebration of National Day. 2 weeks ahead of the event, Minister of Metallurgy Wang Heshu, in a telephone conference, asked provincial leaders to rise to the challenge. They in turn galvanized county representatives by phone the following day. In Yunnan, Si Fuqi ordered everyone to become a soldier in the campaign, announcing a day and night assault for 2 weeks to increase production. Party activists fanned out in the morning, some leaving well before sunrise to reach remote villages in good time. In Dahong County, 200,000 villagers were thrown into the campaign, as the sky shone crimson with the glow cast by thousands of brick furnaces. Villagers dispersed into the forests in search of fuel. Others collected coal, sometimes digging with pick, spade and hands in the open country. In the frenzy to achieve targets, accidents were frequent. Trees were randomly felled, keeling over on villages. Explosive devices used by inexperienced workers to open up mines also claimed lives. Si Fuqi phoned regularly to check the latest results. He, in turn, was egged on by Bo Yibo, who transmitted a new target of 12 million tons, boasting that 40 million workers operated some 500,000 furnaces all over the country. On National Day, Bo announced that October should be the leap month for steel production, and another bout of madness followed. In Yunnan, the number of people involved in the movement jumped from 3 to 4 million, as a special high production week was announced to set another record. "The eyes of the world are fixed on China," exclaimed Si Fuqi, as the country had to achieve the target it had trumpeted, or face a humiliating climb down. With pressure all the way from the top, villagers had little choice but to participate in the campaign. In the Kuching region, Yunnan, floorboards were torn up, and chickens were slaughtered so that their feathers could be used to feed the flames or make bellows. Squads of party activists moved from door to door to collect scrap iron, often confiscating household implements and farming tools. Those who failed to show enough enthusiasm were verbally abused, pushed around, or even tied up and paraded. Critical reports written by party inspectors at the time talk about fear and intimidation. Coming in the wake of a year of relentless campaigns, one following on the heels of the last, irrigation schemes, fertilizer campaign, deep ploughing, close cropping, the onslaught of the people's communes, the mere mention of the slogan, "launching a satellite," was enough to instill dread, as it augured another bitter war, or night battle, in which nobody would be allowed any sleep for days on end. Some tried to slip away and sleep in the cold and wet forest, in order to get a few hours of rest, looking from a distance at the furnaces glowing like fireflies in the night. They were cold and poorly fed. Local carders tried to lower the cost of making steel, thus inflating the figures, by skimping on provisions, which were now entirely in their hands, thanks to the advent of collective canteens. China was dipped into a sea of fire. Everywhere, furnaces were red hot, although the human dramas which played out during the campaign were different in each village. In Yunnan, some farmers were forced to go without adequate food or rest and were worked to death near the furnaces in the rush to complete the production target. In other hamlets across the country, people got away with a small gift of a pot or a pan. But two new dimensions were added to the theatre of violence, nipping in the bud any suspected insubordination. First, carders could now count on the militia established within the people's communes to force through their orders. In Macheng, for instance, militiamen would come to a village and conscript people for work on the furnaces for days on end. One man who left work early was paraded through the streets with a dunce's cap inscribed, "I am a deserter." Second, as all the food was now in the hands of the communes, carders could use rations as a form of reward or punishment. Refusal to work, or any sign of slacking, was punished with a ration cut or deprivation of food altogether. Women who stayed home at night in Macheng to look after their children were banned from the canteen. As Chang Aihua, who lived through the famine in Anhui, later explained, "You did as you were told, otherwise the boss gave you no food. His hand held the ladle." The grip carders had over the food supply was reinforced even further as everywhere pots and pans were routinely taken away. In the cities, too, the campaign was tough on ordinary people. In Nanjing, one furnace alone set a record of 8.8 tons in a single day. But the fires had to be fed constantly, and some teams went so hungry that they fainted by the smelters. Despite huge pressure, still people protested. Wang Manxiao simply refused to work more than 8 hours a day. When challenged by a party secretary, Wang was defiant, asking point-blank, "What are you going to do about it?" Others openly doubted that backyard furnaces would help to overtake Britain in steel production. Close to half of all the workers in some teams were described as backward, meaning that they shirked hard work. In the end, the leadership got its record, although much of it was slag, unwashed ore, or mere statistical invention. Iron ingots from rural communes accumulated everywhere, too small and brittle to be used in modern rolling mills. According to a report from the Ministry of Metallurgy itself, in many provinces, not even a third of the iron produced by backyard furnaces was usable. And the price tag was exorbitant. 1 ton of iron from a backyard furnace was estimated to cost 300 to 350 yuan, twice the amount needed by a modern furnace, to which had to be added 4 tons of coal, 3 tons of iron ore, and 30 to 50 working days. The total losses from the iron and steel drive in 1958 were later estimated by the Bureau for Statistics at 5 billion yuan, not including damage to buildings, forests, mines, and people. When Mikhail Klotchko, a foreign advisor who had grown up in the Ukraine with its undulating and irregular fields, travelled to southern China in the autumn of 1958, he was taken aback by the bare yellow patches of earth divided into narrow terraces. These were the fabled rice paddies, but hardly a single human being could be seen. Where were the farmers? Many were mobilized by the militia on backyard furnaces. Some were deployed on large irrigation schemes, and others had left the village in search of work in the many factories chasing after ever higher targets. In total, more than 15 million farmers moved to the city in 1958, lured by the prospect of a better life. In Yunnan, the number of industrial